I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, and Franklin Roosevelt are all often cited as the greatest U.S. presidents in history. But what makes their leadership so strong? Today we'll talk to presidential historian and C-SPAN advisor Richard Norton Smith. He'll help us understand the qualities on which we grade our leaders, and we'll find out how he contributed to C-SPAN's survey of presidential leadership. He'll also review with us the historic highs and lows of administrations from Obama to Truman, and explain how public perception of our presidents has changed over time. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. From Washington to Wilson, Jackson to Johnson, it's a kind of American parlor game to rank the U.S. presidents from best to worst. On today's show, we talk with a man who's maybe done more thinking on this topic than anybody. But first, let's get a check of what the KCUR newsroom is following today. And for that, let's bring in KCUR's Kyle Palmer. Kyle, nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
A tense morning in Raytown schools. There were some apparent threats against the district online this weekend. What's the latest?
A series of threats made on Snapchat. District officials and police were alerted to these threats by parents who saw the snaps and then reposted some of the images on Facebook and then sent messages to district officials and police. Some of these threats contain images of a handgun. One of them has a caption that reads, quote, "Coming to Raytown February 26th, which is, of course, today. Thanks for bullying," end quote. The district officials decided to add security at Raytown schools today. Of course, many parents were online on Facebook saying they weren't going to have their kids come to school on this day. Mm-hmm. They just to keep them home. Interestingly, the district was already instituting some new procedures in the wake of the Florida school shooting. Like, I think a lot of districts are reevaluating their safety procedures, but they were instituting new fire drill procedures in the aftermath of that Florida shooting because it was reported that the Florida school shooter pulled a fire alarm to get students and teachers out in the open. So the district had sent an email directive to teachers last week that during fire drills now, teachers will step out in the hallways first to look for anything suspicious before evacuating students. So according to a teacher that texted me over the weekend, her school was set to have a fire drill today with this new procedure in place. So it's all just kind of the state of American schools right now. Everyone's on edge. And right now, they don't know the identity of that person who made those threats online. And I guess the Raytown police and FBI are now looking into who possibly was behind that.
Well, meantime, lawmakers are returning to work in Jeff City today for the first time since Governor Eric Greitens was indicted on a charge connected to an extramarital affair. What further developments might we expect there?
House leaders, Greitens' fellow Republicans, have said that they will create a new special committee to investigate allegations of blackmail against the governor and other things kind of swirling around Greitens' office right now. They made that announcement last week after Greitens was indicted on one count of felony invasion of privacy. Now, Greitens continues to maintain that this charge and this investigation is politically motivated, and it would seem many of his supporters, voters who voted for him in 2016, are following that line of argument. KCUR talked to several Republican voters over the last few days. Here's Mike Wren. He's a Republican voter who voted for Greitens and also a small business owner. This is what he has to say about the indictment and this investigation.
I would tell Eric to fight harder than ever. I feel like this feels like a setup to the extent that there's just a group out there to get him.
The charge that this indictment is political comes from the fact that St. Louis Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner, who impaneled the grand jury that issued the indictment, is a former Democratic state lawmaker. The state GOP, we should say, has gone hard at Gardner in the last few days, linking her to billionaire financier George Soros. At the same time, Republican Attorney General Josh Hawley, who is running for U.S. Senate, issued a statement last week. Quote, "A felony indictment by a grand jury is a serious matter. There is no place for party or partisanship. The criminal justice system must be allowed to work. I am confident the House's investigation will be thorough and swift." end quote. So there seems to be a developing split even within the Republican Party about what to do with the fate of Governor Greitens.
And finally today, a rare, some might say, a one-in-a-million birth at Kansas City's Truman Medical Center. What's up there?
Well, the rare birth of identical triplets at Truman Medical Center in Kansas City. The Kansas City Star first reporting that Ron, Elkanah, and Abishai Choga were born last Thursday. The mother is reportedly doing well and still resting and recovering as of yesterday. The Journal of Biosocial Science says identical triplets occur in about every 20 to 30 births out of 1 million. So maybe not quite one in a million, but close enough.
But the sentiment is well intended. Yeah.
The father was quoted by the Star, "Man, we're going to need a bigger car."
And he will, you know. That's KCBR's Kyle Palmer. Kyle, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So who was our greatest president, our worst? It turns out that our views of those questions change as the years passed. But why? And who's well-regarded today who wasn't so well-regarded back in the day? Here's a hint. Our own Harry Truman fits that latter category. Another note, Donald Trump isn't on the list. Current presidents are not, at least the way C-SPAN does it. So we won't be talking about our current chief executive today. But we're going to walk through C-SPAN's 2017 Presidential Historian Survey with the best historical guide I could possibly come up with. Richard Norton Smith has served on the Academic Advisory Committee for C-SPAN's annual presidential rankings. That's because he's a nationally recognized authority on the American presidency. He once worked for Senator Bob Dole and was the founding director of the Dole Institute over in Lawrence. He's written books on Thomas Dewey, Herbert Hoover, and Nelson Rockefeller. Finally, he's giving a series of lectures on this topic with the next one Tuesday night at the Dole Institute of Politics over in Lawrence. More on that in just a little bit. This morning, he joins us from the studios of KPR in Lawrence. Richard, you know how much I enjoy having you with us, and welcome back.
Oh, it's nice to be back, Steve. Thank you for the hospitality.
Well, Barack Obama makes his first appearance on the list this year, the C-SPAN list, and the suspense. Where did he wind up ranking, Richard?
Well, he ranked 12, which is higher than most presidents immediately on leaving office. If you go back and look, typically historians like to hedge their bets. You know, the fact is we're too close, really.
Mm-hmm.
I would say we're too close to the Clinton presidency to pass any kind of enduring judgment. If Hillary Clinton, for example, had been elected president, or if we had not had the Me Too movement, I mean, those are two factors no one could have predicted, but that are, in fact, relevant to how Clinton might stand. So, you know, George W. Bush, it's interesting, in the original survey, right after he left office, he finished very near the bottom. And in the more recent one, he's come up, I think he's in 33rd place. But he's come up a number of slots. And that's the pattern. Presidents leave office usually at the nadir of their reputation. And the reason for that is, you remember Clinton fatigue and Bush fatigue,
sure,
and in some quarters, Obama fatigue. There are a lot of people who are feeling Trump fatigue. And that influences, to some degree, this whole process. It takes time, particularly if you're a polarizing president. You know, Richard Nixon, who certainly knew something about polarization, said it would take 50 years before anyone could write objectively about him. And a couple of things have to happen. Time has to pass for those strong emotions to abate, but also time has to pass for us to get access to a president's papers. You mentioned Harry Truman.
Yeah.
He's a classic example of someone who left office with some of the lowest public approval ratings in history. 20 years later, there was a almost spontaneous rediscovery of Truman. It wasn't because we had discovered a whole lot of new information. It's because we were looking at the existing information with different criteria. We had been through Vietnam. We were going through Watergate. And in comparison, Harry Truman looked like the real deal, a very authentic figure. You know, someone whose word was his bond, someone who was characteristically outspoken, someone you could believe.
Mm-hmm.
And belief, obviously, has taken a hit. Dwight Eisenhower is a different kind of posthumous rediscovery. In his case, he left office very popular with the public, but not with the academics. The first poll that Arthur Schlesinger Jr. took after Ike left office ranked him behind Chester Arthur. All right?
Chester who?
Enough said. But then, guess what? In 1966, his papers were opened. And that year, Murray Kempton, the great columnist for the New York Post, in the days when the Post was a liberal paper, Murray Kempton wrote a column called The Underestimation of Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Hmm.
And it's almost as if he gave liberty, license, you know, to scholars to rethink what they thought they knew about Ike. And in fact, his papers told us that far from the amiable grandfatherly figure of popular legend, that this was a very shrewd,
right,
very gifted politician.
Well, I was really struck, Richard. You know, Dwight Eisenhower ranks fifth in the most recent C-SPAN poll from last year. Harry Truman ranked sixth, and I gather for sure there's not a whole lot of difference there. But still, I was a little surprised that Ike ranked higher than Truman.
Well, there's no doubt that there has been a boomlet. Eisenhower has been adopted by all sorts of people. I would agree with you. I mean, I think Ike probably belongs in the top 10. I think fifth is a little high.
Mm-hmm.
And you could certainly make the case that Truman, with stop and think of the extraordinary range of historic decisions that confronted Truman.
Following World War II. Yeah, absolutely.
Ill-prepared by his own acknowledgement for the presidency. But I mean, you know, from the decision to drop the bomb and prosecute wars in Europe and Japan, to the emerging Cold War, to the creation of the Marshall Plan and NATO, and, you know, on and on and on. And, of course, then the Korean War and the decision to fire Douglas MacArthur, both of which, as you can imagine, drove his poll numbers south dramatically,
mm-hmm.
but which, in the light of, you know, 50, 60 years of intervening events, have come to be seen as a real high point of presidential leadership.
It is amazing to me that these presidents, and you just referred to Eisenhower undergoing this boomlet once upon a time, that how we're thinking of about these men, and they are all men right now, how we're thinking about them evolves over time, and how that really does affect in some dramatic way sometimes how history looks at these people.
Well, listen, I give you something called the 1960s happened, and historians discovered millions of people who had been left by the sidelines of the American story. Obviously, African Americans, but Native Americans, women, and since the 60s, for example, how you feel about the 60s is probably the single best indicator of how you felt about Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They were inseparable, fairly or not. But I'll give you a couple good examples. People have asked, why has Andrew Jackson slipped so far out of historical favor? Jackson, for most of our history, remember, Arthur Schlesinger wrote a book called The Age of Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
He saw Jackson as a forerunner of Franklin Roosevelt. And the fact is, in the context of his times, Jackson was a great democratizer.
Mm-hmm.
In his inaugural address, for example, he called for the abolition of the Electoral College because he thought it was undemocratic.
Mm.
People should vote directly for a president. Now, post-60s, and certainly in our own era, we don't look at Andrew Jackson as the great champion of frontier democracy,
right,
the man who took on the Bank of the United States, you know, and the economic interests of his day. He tends to be seen as a Southern slaveholder who was in some ways directly responsible for a kind of American genocide involving the forced removal of Native Americans from their homes in the South. And it depends, you know, each generation creates its own assumptions, its own conventions, its own prohibitions, if you will. Each generation takes a fresh hook at these presidents. It isn't as if we know a lot more factually about Andrew Jackson, but we're seeing Andrew Jackson through different eyes, as it were. And another factor.
And where does he rank on the list today?
It's funny. Last week, to update the C-SPAN, there was a 170 political scientists. Now, the C-SPAN rankings are done by a very diverse audience. We make a real, real effort to incorporate conservatives as well as liberals, to reach out not only to academics, but to practitioners, to people who have worked in the White House, for example. And a special effort really is made to include women and people of color to make the electorate more representative. But last week for President's Day, a group of 170 political scientists released their own rankings, and they had found Andrew Jackson had slipped to 15th place.
And you guys have been 18th place, I think, in the C-SPAN poll.
Well, you know, and you know, there's a couple reasons for that. One of which has nothing to do with Jackson, per se. And I know we're not here to talk about Donald Trump, but the fact is that because Trump has chosen to identify himself with Andrew Jackson, and I'm not sure how much he actually knows about Andrew Jackson, but in any event, he has, in effect, in the eyes of Trump critics, who I think probably would predominate among 170 political scientists, he's almost sullied Jackson's reputation further.
Well, he's 18th in the C-SPAN poll. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking with the eminent historian Richard Norton Smith about the latest C-SPAN rankings of American presidents. If you want to join our conversation with your thoughts on where these people rank, you can go online and see a complete ranking. 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. And I should point out that the Dole Institute's 2018 presidential election series featuring Richard Norton Smith is free to the public. The next talk will be at 7 on Tuesday evening at the Dole Institute of Politics over in Lawrence. The title of that talk, Learning from Success, Parts 3 and Parts 4, will be in March 12th and 14th. More information at the Dole Institute's website. Richard, does it go without saying that more contemporary presidents will tend to rank more highly given the degree of difficulty of the job today compared to 150 years ago?
That's a great question. One of the reasons why, the older I get, the more skeptical, frankly, I become of this ranking business is because the fact of the matter is one size does not fit all. Mm-hmm. The presidency in our time, certainly the presidency, say, from Franklin Roosevelt on, is a drastically different office from what it was in the 19th century. One of the criteria that always show up, understandably, in academic surveys is economic management. How did a president perform in terms of the economy? But the fact is, the question is almost inapplicable to a Martin Van Buren or a Grover Cleveland, each of whom had great depressions on their watch, and neither of whom was expected by the general public or their political parties to really lift a finger to try to combat what was seen as an almost divine kind of boom and bust theory of American capitalism. Ironically, you know, he takes a lot of criticism for his performance, but the first president who broke with that was Herbert Hoover. Hoover did not believe in the boom and bust theory, and the fact is, he did more than any of his predecessors to involve the federal government in combating the Great Depression. He, of course, did not do anywhere near as much as FDR and his successors did. And for that, he has paid a real price historically.
Right.
But in any event, I mean, the fact is now we're almost entering, I think, a postmodern presidency when I think there is an increased level of economic sophistication. You know, half of Americans are in the stock market. We're connected with the world and the global economy. I think there's a growing perception that a president's personal ability, you know, to increase our paycheck or provide job security is, in fact, probably more limited than we have traditionally thought. Now, that doesn't mean if the economy tanks tomorrow that the fingers won't be pointed at the White House. But I think particularly in good times, if you know, for example, again, to go back to the Clinton administration, and you know, we had a long period of economic growth and actually a couple of years of balanced federal budgets, which was pretty historic in itself. And yet, polls showed, and some of this was the polarization of politics, people unwilling to give credit to the president, whereas they might have to another a president of another party. But the polls showed that people gave as much credit to Alan Greenspan and the Federal Reserve as they did to the White House.
Yeah.
Now, in many ways, I think that's a pretty sophisticated reading. But yeah. I think it also it helps to explain why, looking at modern presidents, and now, I think postmodern presidents, they don't have the same tools that FDR had or Richard Nixon had. You know, Richard Nixon, who's not thought of as a great communicator, but the fact is, in the fall of 1970, when the Vietnam protests threatened really to overrun his White House, Richard Nixon had the capacity, which any of his contemporaries had, of calling three men in towers in New York who owned networks, the only three networks. There was no cable TV. Mm-hmm. There was no internet. And that night, he was assured of an audience of 70 or 80 million people. And the next day, you could be sure that the conversation around the water cooler was, you know, what did you think of the president's speech last night?
Right.
And the fact is, Nixon could move the numbers with the silent majority speech, for example, increased support for his Vietnam policy by 11 points overnight. That option does not exist.
Yeah.
For a modern president.
That's interesting. Hey, how does C-SPAN conduct these reviews, Richard? What's the process that you guys have implemented?
Well, it's interesting. It's evolved. We've done three of them, and actually in some ways ill-timed, because each one came right after the conclusion of a two-term presidency. So, of course, everyone, you know, wants to know right away, what do you think of blank who's just left office?
Who sets the timing of these things?
Well, you know, it's something that Brian Lamb and Susan Swain and the management get together. They have an informal group of people that they consult with. I've been one of those folks for all three of these. And then we all work very hard to identify participants and, as I say, to make sure that it's a representative group. And we put together the criteria. For example, in part to reflect some of the concerns that I've talked about, we in our criteria, we include a question that, again, wouldn't really apply to most 19th century presidents. It's one of the criteria is the pursuit of justice and social justice in particular.
Barack Obama did very well in that category.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, Lyndon Johnson would certainly rank at the top of that category. I mean, that because, you know, that is, in fact, a significant part of a modern president's job. Harry Truman said the main function of the modern president is persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, your grandfather's presidency had tools of persuasion that are really largely missing. When's the last time you heard anyone, you know, stop the conversation to talk about an Oval Office address? The irony of the Obama years is people have used the term. Some people think it's pejorative. Some people think it's a compliment. But they talk about Obama as a professorial type. I think Barack Obama's instinct and great talent is for persuasion, for reasoning with people. And in some ways, the tragedy almost of his presidency was he occupied the office at a time when very few people were interested in being persuaded. And arguably, millions of people were interested in being unreasonable. And so in some ways, his greatest talents almost were irrelevant. He was unable to move the body politic in the way that in a different political culture,
right,
people as disparate as Truman or Eisenhower could.
Let's do this, Richard. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll run down the top of the list. We'll talk about the bottom of the list, and we'll get phone calls from our listeners, too, with their thoughts on who should rank as the top of the heap when it comes to our presidents, who should be at the bottom. 816-235-2888 is our number here. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Again, Richard Norton Smith speaks on Tuesday evening at the Dole Institute of Politics at 7 o'clock. He'll be talking about learning from success as a result of these rankings. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. You can hear what two area lawmakers had to say about the indictment of Governor Eric Greitens last Friday. That conversation is in podcast form with other previous broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, a look at how literature has shaped our culture and how technology is changing how we write. And we get a glimpse of humanity's destiny beyond Earth. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. This hour, we're visiting with the well-known historian, presidential historian, Richard Norton Smith. He's the founding director of the Dole Institute of Politics over in Lawrence. He's written books on Tom Dewey, Herbert Hoover, and Nelson Rockefeller. He joins us this morning from KANU over in Lawrence. We're talking about the rankings, the historical rankings of our president. Well, Richard, let's break the suspense and run down the top of this list, the top five as presidential historians see them based on the C-SPAN list from last year. Run it down for us.
Well, I'll tell you, one thing I would take issue with, when you said that, they're subject to change, and of course there is subject to great change, and we could talk about that. What doesn't change, year after year, poll after poll, is what I call the Holy Trinity.
Yes.
of American presidents.
Right.
And you can pick them. Who comes in number? Lincoln is usually one. Washington is two, and FDR is three.
Mm-hmm.
And you stop thinking about it. One in the 18th century, one in the 19th century, and one in the 20th. Washington, without whom there would not be a presidency, and arguably there might very well not be an American republic.
Right. Right.
Lincoln, who
There might not be an American republic also, yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But created a new union. He didn't simply, the great failing of Andrew Johnson, among others, and there were many, was that he used to use the term restoration,
mm-hmm.
not reconstruction. And the fact, of course, is that Lincoln understood a new birth of freedom meant a new birth of freedom. It meant that we were creating, in effect, a different America from the loose confederation of states that existed before the war.
Andrew Johnson, who followed Lincoln, ranks second to the bottom on this latest
list. And I would put him at the bottom. I mean, there's not a lot of difference. It's interesting, though, if you notice, the worst presidents surround the great presidents.
That's interesting. Because the worst president on this list is James Buchanan, who
right.
preceded Lincoln as president.
And
right.
Franklin Pierce is down at the bottom,
yes.
too. If you could argue it was the failures of the president, let's not make the mistake of exaggerating, particularly given the limited powers of a president in the 19th century. There was a failure of the American political system. But nevertheless, Pierce and the Kansas-Nebraska Act was a perverse invitation
mm-hmm.
to war. And Buchanan, who dithered for 4 years, and had a genius for inaction at a time when literally, I mean, you know, who knows? Who knows if Lincoln had been president and if you'd switched between Lincoln and Buchanan? There is this notion that, you know, God tends to look out for the American people. Mm-hmm. There's something providential. I mean, after the disasters of the 1850s and the secession of a dozen southern states, lots of people basically gave up on the American experiment. And then along, no one really would have predicted that Abraham Lincoln, a largely unknown,
right,
one-term congressman, mm-hmm, from Illinois, who had essentially retired from politics to practice law in Springfield, and he was nominated precisely because he was unknown, because, yeah, he didn't have a long record that people could attack.
His story staggers still today.
It is the great American story.
Mm-hmm.
He is impervious to criticism. I mean, there is criticism. There will always be, and that's healthy. But you know, Lincoln, I tell you what, if you want to know, I think, the ultimate yardstick by which to measure the performance of any president, and that applies to whatever century, whatever model, you know, that you're looking at, from the beginning to today, it's something that Lincoln said in his annual message to Congress in 1862, the speech where he famously said, "We cannot escape history."
Mm-hmm.
But he said, "The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion." There you have it.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is, the presidency is more a reactive than a proactive position. It isn't what a president says in his inaugural address that will ultimately redound to his permanent place, whatever it is, in history. It's how he reacts to the unforeseen,
right,
to that proverbial 3 o'clock in the morning phone call. And Lincoln, that was true in Lincoln's day. Lincoln monumentally rose with the occasion, grew. You know, we all like to think our presidents grow. You know, they put their hands on the Bible and they say those 33 magic words, and it's like, you know, pixie dust is spread over them, and they become larger.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they do. I would argue John F. Kennedy, who was in the top eight, I think Kennedy grew in office. On the other hand, most of them are like Warren Harding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not like Warren Harding, thank God, but they're like Warren Harding in that, you know, what you see is what you get, and they don't all grow in office.
Let's run down the other top finishers here. Theodore Roosevelt finished his fourth, a relation to FDR, who's number three on this list. Dwight Eisenhower, we've mentioned, number five. Harry Truman, number six. Thomas Jefferson, number seven.
Yeah, and I would take issue with that. Jefferson, well, there are two things. Jefferson is celebrated for
things
what
he did outside the presidency.
Was,
yeah.
Before, exactly. Mm-hmm. Before he was president. And for the great vision he displayed in buying Louisiana. And in fact, in doing so, he laid down another law. You know, I would argue that character counts. And one way that presidents display character is the willingness under pressure, when the good of the country is at stake, to part company with their own philosophical,
mm-hmm,
convictions. Jefferson, of course, was a small government man. He was a great strict constructionist, we would call him. And yet, when Louisiana came on the market, his continental vision trumped his small government, mm-hmm, principles. Mm-hmm. He said, "I stretched the Constitution so far it cracked." But most of us, I think, would be grateful that he did.
Right, right. Some other recent presidents, Ronald Reagan is ninth. He's steadily moved up one slot in each in the last three rankings here. John F. Kennedy is number eight, just ahead of him. LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, number 10. Barack Obama, number 12. This is interesting. The presidents of the 1970s, Gerald Ford, 25. Jimmy Carter is 26.
Yeah, right about the middle. Well, you know, there's a curse.
Richard Nixon, 28. Yeah.
You know, we're all embarrassed to have experienced the 1970s. How many clothes closets, you know, in the far far recess, you know, have leisure suits.
Right.
There's something about the 70s. It was a terribly difficult era, and I'm not sure even now we've really come to terms with it. It's a little bit like the Gilded Age, which is another, you know, the post-Civil War era that tends to there's a wonderful historian named Richard White who refers to the Gilded Age as flyover country for most American historians. I think the 70s may be the modern version. It was very difficult to be a president in the 70s. And remember, you were dealing with the aftermath of Vietnam and Watergate, the cynicism, the distrust of government. The parties were themselves undergoing enormous change. There were elements of reform that were at work. I mean, the old rules, you know, you could push the old familiar buttons and nothing happened. And of course, Gerald Ford did not have a mandate of an election behind him. And Jimmy Carter arguably could only have won the presidency under the unusual circumstances in 1976.
Right.
There's a pretty well universal sense that Carter has been a very successful ex-president.
Right.
And he is recognized for that. I will tell you, there's a book coming this spring by Stuart Eisenstadt.
Oh, sure. Yeah, from his staff.
And Eisenstadt, it's wonderful. I've read it. He had 5,000 pages of handwritten yellow legal pad notes from all the meetings and everything else that he sat in. And the great thing about Eisenstadt is, although he certainly admires Carter, he is detached enough to be critical. Huh. So the book has credibility. And I think it may do something significant for President Carter's reputation. When people look at the Carter presidency, you know, it's more than the hostage crisis and runaway interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a lot of legislative accomplishment to talk about.
He's actually dropped over the years from 22nd in 2000 to 25th in 2009, 26th now in 2017. And again, if our listeners have any thoughts on how these rankings played out, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You don't rate the current office holder. Maybe this is the elephant in the room here. And I'm sure there are listeners out there who would love to do that now.
I'll tell you. And in fact, as I say, my growing skepticism about this process has to do with the fact that it's too soon, as I've said, really to pass judgment on several recent presidents. Certainly, it's impossible as a rule to provide any kind of a perspective on an incumbent, whoever that incumbent is, whatever his performance may be. You know, you may have private feelings, and I'm like anyone else, but, you know, perspective is something that requires time, as I said earlier. Now, it may come of interest to you that the 170 political scientists to whom I referred last week,
right?
They observed no such restriction in their survey that was released last week. And for whatever it's worth, and it's them, not us, but they placed the incumbent president dead last behind James Buchanan.
Dead last?
Yeah.
Wow. Behind Buchanan, behind Harding, Nixon, all those guys.
I think, you know, that illustrates, it tells us as much about them, I think, as it does about the president. And I have no doubt there would be people out there who would agree with him, and there would be people out there who would take violent exception. But that's my point. The intense polarization that surrounds this presidency argues against, you know, there's a difference between editorial. There's a reason why they say journalists write the first draft of history.
Mm-hmm.
And journalistic opinion about an incumbent, it's fine. I mean, it's their business. It's what they do every day. But there is a difference between journalistic assessments, which naturally are based on the very much here and now, and historical assessments. Yeah, enough said.
Yeah. 816-235-2888. Is there one president that you think will shift positions in the years to come, maybe more than the others, or someone you're keeping an eye on?
Well, I like to think I'm writing a great big biography of Gerald Ford.
Are you?
And I can tell you, people are going to be surprised. I'm surprised. People are going to be very surprised, a lot of things. Ford's wife and his presidency. They're both a lot, frankly, a lot more interesting and a lot more colorful, actually, than people believe. So
he's 25th right now on the list.
But no, it's interesting. Coolidge, which for a long time was sort of a joke, certainly among the Arthur Schlesinger school of historians, they thought of him as a nullity. You know, H.L. Mencken said he was the greatest man ever to come from Plymouth Notch, Vermont. And when he died in 1933, Dorothy Parker said, "How could they tell?" You know, that was the literati. You know. But the fact is, since Reagan, you know, Reagan's made it respectable to be a Coolidge conservative. And by that I mean, at the gross oversimplification, but pivot around the word freedom. Freedom is the one word that I think all Americans can agree on, even if we certainly don't agree on what it means. The fact is, Teddy Roosevelt said there are two kinds of presidents, Lincoln presidents and Buchanan presidents. Well, at the similar oversimplification, I would say there are two kinds of presidents. There are presidents who promise us freedom through government. Think of FDR or LBJ.
Right.
And there are presidents who promise us freedom from government.
Yeah.
And think of Reagan or Coolidge or Jefferson.
Yeah. I haven't mentioned Bill Clinton. He ranked 15th here. Let's go to Emily from Kansas City, Missouri. Emily, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Emily.
Hi. I was just curious on why Richard Nixon was ranked 28th. That seemed a little high to me.
Huh.
Well, you know, that's a good point. And in fact, Nixon has come up in modestly. He will never escape, you know, the opening line of his historical obit, which is the first president ever forced to resign.
Yeah, right.
On the other hand, how do you see, this is another reason why this ranking business is so problematic. The fact of the matter is Nixon had great accomplishments in office, and not just opening to China or, you know, a detente with the Soviet Union. But if you look at the domestic scene, you know, 18-year-olds got the vote. He created OSHA. Affirmative action was actually a child of the Nixon administration. He actually desegregated Southern schools more than his predecessors. I mean, there's a lot to point to. On the other hand, and we have presidents like this. Woodrow Wilson had a phenomenally successful first term, created the Federal Reserve, the Federal Trade Commission, the eight-hour workday. He put Louis Brandeis, the first Jew, on the Supreme Court. And then he had a second term dominated by the war and its aftermath and the failed League of Nations, which is as unsuccessful as his first term was successful.
Lyndon Johnson sort of might mirror some of that then.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you measure, okay, what's more important, Vietnam, which I think everyone can, pretty much everyone can agree was a failed policy, versus the premier record on civil rights, certainly since Lincoln.
Right.
And a man who insisted that America had a moral obligation to address the needs of the poor.
Right.
I mean, when's the last time you heard a president really talk with that kind of conviction?
It's been a while.
Yeah.
We're going to leave our conversation there. Richard Norton Smith will be speaking again Tuesday evening at 7 at the Dole Institute of Politics on this notion of presidential rankings. He'll speak again on March 12th and 14th. More information about all his talks at the Dole Institute's website. Look forward to his biography on Gerald Ford. Richard, thanks so much for the time. Always great to have you here.
Oh, my pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
You bet. Coming up, Greg Eklund. We're talking sports. Basketball fans are getting riled up for Thursday. It's the beginning of March and the beginning of another March Madness. The Big 12 men's tournament starts March 7th, and the first round of the NCAA men's tournament starts March 15th. Here to update us on some big news out of college basketball is KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund. And Greg, always good to have you here.
Glad to be here, Steve.
What's the biggest headline from this weekend? KU share of its 14th straight Big 12 title. We didn't think it was going to happen. Or the FBI investigation into college basketball. Right now, I'm putting my bet on the latter.
You are entirely correct. There is no question about that because we had mentioned from the outset of this season how when we had learned of the investigation that this could be the biggest thing since the college basketball scandal of the 1950s. Well, based on the news that came out on Friday, it certainly looks like it is.
Remind us what came out on Friday. What's happened?
It was the report by Yahoo, which named names, named players, named programs. And Kansas was among the programs named primarily because of Josh Jackson, whose mother was allegedly given an amount of money. And whether that had an influence on him going to Kansas or not, that is yet to be determined. But the fact that his name is tied in with this investigation is an ominous sign.
So where do you think this thing's going? What do you anticipate here, Greg?
Wow. That's that is the million-dollar question right now.
Just a notion that there's lots of scandals that we haven't become aware of yet that are lurking out there.
Well, at least that they have never come to light like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, the underbelly of college athletics has always been there, especially in the last several years, where people had the idea that something like this was going on, but never an FBI investigation. So now, with more than 4,000 wiretaps and an internal investigation that is turning up names and places like we've never seen before, that this will have a huge impact on college basketball.
You just said 4,000 wiretaps?
Yes.
So that begins to suggest how wide sweeping this.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And we've already seen the price of it with some players who are currently with their teams and a couple of coaches. Before the season, Rick Pitino was relieved of his duties at Louisville. Then just over the weekend, Arizona, Sean Miller, a team expected to be among the contenders for the Final Four this year, stepped aside as the coach of the Arizona Wildcats, and one of his players is still in question as well.
So big reforms probably on the horizon then as a result of all this.
Well, sure, because there are still some players who are in question at Michigan State. Bridges, who came back for his senior year, right here in this part of the country. Texas is not playing Eric Davis at the moment. He's another player who's out of the Detroit area, and among those who is the center of an investigation, an internal investigation at Texas right now. He won't play at Lawrence tonight when the Longhorns are playing KU, and likely not to play in the Big 12 tournament either.
How do coaches fare after scandals like this, Greg? I mean, would any school hire Arizona's head coach, Sean Miller, after something like
this? Well, based on past methods and practices, he'll likely find a job somewhere. Maybe not at a Power 5 school, but let's think back to when Dave Bliss was involved in a murder cover-up at Baylor University.
Wow.
I mean, Christian schools were hiring him on the NAIA level. Can you imagine that job interview? Well, Dave, it says here you're involved in a murder cover-up.
Right.
And yet he got the job.
Wow. You have to wonder how all this is going to affect the upcoming NCAA tournament.
Absolutely. Because, as we had mentioned, with the present players, the past players, it's interesting that the coach taking over at Arizona is Lorenzo Romar. And Lorenzo Romar was at Washington last season before he was fired. He almost had Michael Porter Jr. and Markelle Fultz, who was the number one overall pick in the NBA draft this year, mm-hmm. also played at Washington under Lorenzo Romar.
Wow. Okay.
And Foltz is another one of the names that was mentioned in the investigation.
Lorenzo Romar tied to Michael Porter Jr., the big MU star who's been sidelined all season with an injury. Speaking of him, he was cleared last week to practice. Are we going to see Michael Porter on the court more than we have already this year? What a crushing disappointment for Mizzou
fans. Oh, yeah, just 2 minutes of the game to open the season after all that excitement and buildup, and he gets the first basket and turned out to be his only basket of the season so far. He is cleared to practice. He'll be practicing this week. They have one home game left this Saturday against Arkansas. Mm. They play tomorrow night at Vanderbilt. MU needs some kind of lift. They're in the midst of a 3-game losing streak. I would not be surprised to see Michael Porter on the floor in the very near future.
Now, this surprised me. Those selections to the men's and women's NCAA tournament are still a couple weeks away. Top seeds were released for both the men and women recently. What does that mean, and why are they doing that now?
This is the committee, the men's selection committee, that is doing this, much in the same vein as the college football playoff selection committee does in the fall. Why? Because it creates interest. It creates excitement. It creates anticipation. And also,
but those can change still, though, right?
It could change. A couple of weeks ago, Kansas was projected as a number 2 seed and to go out west. And that affects people's planning for the NCAA tournament if they want to follow their respective teams. Now, as a co-winner of the Big 12 Conference regular season title, KU is probably positioning itself as a number 1 seed, which could change the whole geography of
the league. You got to hand it to Bill Self. Neither one of us thought they were going to be where they are right now.
No, I mean, to go, when we had talked a few weeks ago when they went to West Virginia and won there, and then over the weekend winning at Texas Tech, an incredible feat for this team.
Just quickly, all this basketball news, and then there's a soccer story. A new season opens Sunday night at Children's Mercy Park. Sporting KC plays NYC FC. Catch us up on the off-season developments for Sporting.
Well, the biggest name that will be missing from the Sporting lineup this season will be Benny Failhaber, a popular scoring midfielder who had his best years of his career with Sporting Kansas City, but he was traded in the offseason to Los Angeles for allocation money. It's a sign that Sporting is aware that it's getting a little long in the tooth in some areas, and we had talked before about Matt Beisler and Graham Zuzzi, getting up there in years, not too many opportunities to compete for a championship left for them. So they are making that transition, starting with the Failhaber move.
We'll have to leave it there. That's KCR Sports contributor Greg Eklund. Greg, always good to have you here. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Steve.
Tomorrow, how literature has shaped our culture and what technology is going to get us to Mars and beyond. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.